Hello.
This is Robert Stark. I am joined here with Andy Nowicki.
Hello, Robert. Good to be with you.
So your latest book, it's called This Malignant Mirage, and it's an erotic novel.
Yes, it's an erotic anthology. I think it's a collection of short stories that you can file them under erotica, but I like to think of them as being erotica plus, which is to say that yes, they are about sex, and yes, there is erotic content, but there is substance as well.
And the thing is, with you, Andy, I mean, most people don't really think of you as being a really erotic person.
Ah, well, speak for yourself. I don't know about that.
I'm not dissing you, but I mean, they I mean, not erotic in the sense that you have an image of you're very sex negative. Your articles are about how dangerous sex is.
Yeah, well, I believe we live in a time of destructive hedonism, and I am a traditionalist when it comes to sex. I believe, that sex is, I believe that in the wisdom of the ancients that, sex is a very destructive, or can be a very destructive force, if it's abused. Which is to say, if it's not used correctly, I'm a believer I'm not a believer in premarital sex. I think sex belongs in marriage and only in marriage. And yet, at the same time,
or in your writings.
Well, a writer has to examine everything. It has to cover. What's out there? What's out there to be covered? The subject matter that's screaming out to be written about. And so I have this sense of, also, I'm talking about my moral beliefs right now. But I also have a sense of sex, aesthetically speaking. Which I've covered, I think I've written about this elsewhere, as really a very disruptive force. It's something that, I've compared it to, the end of innocence. And I think we all have a sense of that as well, that when sexuality, unfolds or within us, when we become sexualized, we lose something. And it's part of our design, and it's part of, God's plan in one way or another. But there is, I'm conscious of a loss, and so there's a lot of ambiguity, I would say, in my presentation of sex, and yet it's something that I think needs to be covered, and I think I do so. I don't think anyone could say that I'm squeamish or prudish in the way that I cover it.
Because you're not afraid to cover anything. We talked on this before in one of our shows about the Ned Flanderization of Christian social conservatives,
right?
Who are extremely squeamish about talking about anything remotely sexual. You're not. I mean, you basically. You come across as someone you're not easily shocked. You're basically aware of everything that's out there.
I had an article that I wrote for Alternative Right. I think it was maybe about 3 years ago now, called "Sex and Violence Traditionalism," where I talked about this very thing. There is this among many, I would say, many social conservatives. There is this idea that. Everything has to be squeaky clean, and nothing can be dark or edgy or whatever you want to call it. Edgy is kind of an overused word, but you know it's a useful word for what I'm trying to talk about here. And so yeah, I but I talk about how there are plenty of works of fiction and drama and otherwise. There's stuff from the Bible. I mean, if you read the Bible, your mind will be blown by a lot of the stories that you find there. And yeah, if you put them in the proper context, it's moral. It's teaching us things that are good, but they are, the content, is not exactly G rated. And so, like you were saying, I'm a believer that a writer, an artist, even a social conservative, as I am a social and moral, conservative, has an obligation to really delve into, reality and all of the not so pretty, somewhat disturbing, things that are out there, whether it concerns, sex or violence or profanity or whatever.
So, is this book similar to your last one, Beauty and the Least, where the erotic leads to bad things or disaster?
It's interesting you should ask that. The Beauty and the Least, which was is published through Hopeless Books and Sterzinger's company out of Chicago. Beauty and the Least was originally going to be a part of this collection that makes up this Malignant Mirage, and then I decided that it really, it's a, Beauty and the Least is novella length, so it's on the longer side as short stories go, but on the shorter side certainly as novels go, and I decided to make it a standalone because I thought it really belonged by itself, and also because there is one work in particular in this Malignant Mirage that covers a lot of the same thematic ground as Beauty and the Least. There's the same issue of telepathic relationship between real life strangers, although it takes a slightly different form. And in this Malignant Mirage, my latest my anthology, that story is entitled Colette's Dream Man. That story, Colette's Dream Man, and Beauty and the Least, there was significant overlap, there was enough significant overlap in the storylines that I wanted to separate the two. I mean, you want to have some, when you have an anthology of short stories, it's okay to have some, thematic, ground that's similar from one story to another, but there was a little too much similarity, and so I wanted to separate them, push them apart. Plus, I also thought Beauty and the Least is really, really works best as a standalone. So to answer your question, it came out of the same era of writing, roughly speaking, that all of these stories sprung out of. But Beauty and the Least, I decided to make its own thing.
And it's for ER Books, so ERF Books, does that specialize in erotica?
It's the same company that published my work, my novel Heart Killer, which was published in 2012 by ER Books. They are a company out of London that publishes exclusively online, and yes, it's they publish erotica, but they publish some things that are non-erotica as well, and some things that are maybe occupy some middle ground. I think my work probably is some kind of hybrid between erotica and non-erotica. It's certainly not, Matt Forney called it anerotic erotica, like an erotic, meaning not erotic erotica. Which I don't quite. I mean, I kind of like the sound, the ring of that, but I don't think it quite describes it. Because hopefully it is erotic, and I think it is. But I also think there is another dimension to it as well. There's more substance to it than that.
with the erotic aspects, were you going for, like, shock value?
Well, sometimes, yeah, there is a real, you know, not, the, I wouldn't say shock value for the sake of being shocking. But I really am a big fan of shock value. By shock value, you mean it's something that just sort of catches the reader's attention and is really bold and brazen and says, look here, I know how you want me to be, I know how I'm supposed to be, but I'm not going to be this way. I mean, it's part of my general anti-politically correct stance. And I think that, you know, we live in a time, it's very interesting, I talked about this with Matt, we live in a time where, on the one hand, everything is sexualized, you know, in ways that were, that was never the case before, before the, let's say, the sexual revolution and all the fallout, after the sexual revolution, which we're still, going through right now. So on the one hand, everything is sexualized, but yet on the other hand, there are these politically correct forces, a lot of them are feminists, who, you know, say, like, Lacey Green, this blogger, or vlogger, I guess you'd call her, had something where she was talking about, BDSM, you know, bondage.
Yeah, I saw that,
At bondage and S&M, what's the novel? The famous novel, the one about, 50 Shades of Grey. You know, the big sensation that caused. And that, you know, in some way, and I'm not saying that 50 Shades of Grey is a great book by any stretch, but it does show something about how there is still this desire, apparently, that women have, to be submissive. And, you know, that's really, interesting, isn't it? That we live in this time of this feminist, you know, age where everything is about female empowerment and blah, blah, blah. And yet what women are swooning over is this dashing, leading man, who's a dominant, who's a dominator.
Was Lacey Green saying that she prefers to be submissive or she prefers to be dominant?
Well, she was just saying now, you know, it's okay. Bondage and S&M is great. We're just exploring, you know, our sexuality, but it's really important to have a safe word, and it's really important to, and she was saying all this stuff that was sort of like that was taking this very provocative thing, this provocative activity, bondage, submission, and trying to more or less tame it and say, no, it doesn't really mean all these objectionable things that we don't want it to mean.
And she and if you haven't seen her videos, she has a very kind of a bubbly personality.
Oh, she's cute. Yes. I mean, yeah. she's appealing. And yet her message is just so, was so wrong. So warped on so many levels because it was just a sort of typical feminist kind of angle, like, you know, oh no, don't look at this, don't consider the ramifications of female submission, the desire for female submission, which is obviously there, otherwise this book wouldn't have, you know, sold as well as it did, but it's not really about submission, it's about empowerment, you know, this whole word, quote unquote empowerment, just all the typical kind of stuff, I'm sure she's a nice person and she's cute and everything. But, it was just so annoying.
You asked Lacey to see if she could review your work?
I have not. I somehow don't get the feeling I would be able to get a response from her, but it's an idea. Maybe I'll try it.
You should. So, let's get to one of your stories. So you have one. It's between a doctor, a patient and his psychiatrist. And, wasn't one of your other stories in Lost File and Souls about a patient and a psychiatrist?
It's a theme that I've covered a few times, and Matt was kind of, raking me over the coals for it in a friendly way because I know he likes my stuff. But it's a circumstance that I've, it's a thematic circumstance that I've covered a few, it's ground that's well covered by me. it was first actually that scenario was first turned up in a story that I wrote called The Doctor and the Heretic, which was a part of a book, The Doctor and the Heretic and Other Stories, which involved a complicated relationship between a beautiful psychiatrist and her terribly messed up younger patient, a relationship that turned romantic, which of course, you know, doctor-patient relationships are not supposed to. If there's a barrier there, and that's part of the whole allure of it, I guess it's something that's not supposed to be. But yes, you're right. Also, there was also a story in the collection Lost Violent Souls, which I published through Counter Currents. In that story, there's erotic tension, let's say, between the doctor and the patient. But nothing specifically happens. And in this case, in the story that you're referring to from this Malignant Mirage, I'm returning to that general thematic ground, only this time sort of upping the ante a little bit, in that the name of the story itself is provocative, and I don't think Lacey Green would like it. It's called The Rape of the Therapist. And of course, therapist is, some have pointed this out, how it's the rapist pushed together.
You're right. Yeah, if you read it.
So the story is about a desperate man, and a lot of my stories are about desperate people. I think that's something that I gravitate towards for whatever reason. He visits his psychiatrist, and basically he comes in with a cyanide pill in hand, and he threatens. He says, "I'm going to take this pill and kill myself unless you permit me to have sex with you." And so, you know, it's a complicated kind of the way I explained it just now doesn't make it sound very appealing, but it's a complicated situation and with a lot of dimensions on either side, and hopefully it's like I said, something where the disturbingly erotic nature of certain relationships and certain boundaries that aren't supposed to be crossed, and also desperation. Human desperation, which is a part of the human, I think part of the entire human experience. It's part of what it means to be human, is to be aware from time to time of being in a desperate state. And so hopefully, ultimately, like I said, it's about more than just the erotic, but there is that aspect of it.
So you're saying sexuality is such a powerful force, it can drive someone to do basically anything.
It can be a dangerous thing, and that's something that I think maybe even Lacey Green knows. I wasn't thinking we were going to spend so much time talking about Lacey Green tonight.
Let's just invite her on our panel and
that would be interesting.
I'm not opposed to having her as a guest. She's welcome on the show.
I think that the politically correct kind of these feminists and whatever, they recognize that, the kind of people who want to talk about safe words and empowerment and blah, blah, blah. They recognize what we're talking about, that sex can be a dangerous force. And like I said, it's something that I feel moved as a writer, as an artist, to write about and to cover aesthetically. But I'm aware of, you know, that it's not just. I'm aware that hedonism, sexual hedonism, is a not very compelling philosophy or way to live one's life.
Speaking about that, have you been following the news with the shooting?
Yes. Now, that's in your neck of the woods, isn't
yes,
it?
Yes. I live in Santa Barbara. And ironically enough, I'm working on a sitcom that takes place basically about in the same in Isla Vista. I'm working on a sitcom about it. My sitcom is original. I've been working on my sitcom a long time, so I'm not borrowing ideas from him. It's purely coincidental. So don't look at me.
Wow.
But
okay.
This is in my neck of the woods, and I was when this happened, I was thinking like this guy reminds me a lot of one of the characters in Andy Nowicki's books.
You know, you're not the first person to tell me that. Colin Liddell, my the co-editor of Alternative Right, was actually passed that message along to me last night. Terrible story. One of these gruesome mass murders. And we have a video in this case, not just a manifesto, not just a written thing, but we have something where this guy, this young man who's the son of somebody in Hollywood, somebody who's done
I think his father was one of the producers on The Hunger Games.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And so he produced. He gave us this this video where he talks about everything that he's going to do and all the revenge he's going to get on the girls who've rejected him for all these many years. You know who it reminded me of? There a few years ago, there was the a shooting at an LA fitness club.
Oh yeah, George Sodini.
George Sodini. Yeah. This seems very. He was a little older. I think he was around 40, but he said he had the same kind of complaints about women not like about wanting sex, but getting rejected all the time and so yeah. I mean I in this case it's a younger guy. The video was just bizarre because it didn't seem like it seemed like a screen test to me. Have you watched it?
Yeah, I have. Yeah, it sounded like a. You know what it kind of reminded me of? A lot of people are saying this, but have you seen Christian Bale in American Psycho? It does remind me of the scene, especially. Have you seen the scene in American Psycho where he's giving that monologue about like do you like Phil Collins?
Yes. Yeah.
And he was really into 80s music, and that's another theme. You also have the 80s themes going in your books, so there's just all these different connection parallels.
Yeah, that was the decade of my my teenage years, my adolescent
decade. He has one of these videos, he's driving on the beach and he's listening, to that song, A Higher Love, and he's like, and he's like putting the camera to himself and you're hearing like, Higher Love, and he's like smiling.
Yeah.
And
I mean, I'm laughing, but I mean, it is kind of funny, but of course it's, in the light of what he did, it's just very disturbing too.
It's disturbing, but something can be disturbing and have humor to it at the same time.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I what was so bizarre to me, I haven't seen that video. I saw the one where he's just sitting in his car, the one that where he's talking about what is it, the day of reckoning or something like that. He has some apocalyptic way of talking about it. And it just seemed like. I mean, I had a hard time taking him seriously. I mean, it seemed like it was like, it reminded me of a screen test or an audition or something like, I'm gonna play this crazy guy here. He even had this little chuckle that he would do. This sort of, thing. That was just,
People were saying kind of like comparing him to a Bond villain.
Yes. It seems completely contrived. And I don't know that these people like this, I mean, but apparently it's real, you know? So apparently this rage that he feels, and it's this very narcissistic rage, this sort of like, you know, I deserve these things and I'm being denied them, so I'm gonna kill a bunch of people. Apparently these feelings are really real, and yet he also is playing a part, like trying to be, like you say, I don't know if it's a Bond villain or just some spooky, creepy, scary bad guy. And yet he, you know, he doesn't really come across that way. So it's one of those really, complicated sorts of things. I haven't paid as much attention to the story as I have to similar stories in the past, just because, I don't know, I've been sort of preoccupied.
Yeah, I mean, I would think out of all people, you would be the one who would be covering this.
Yeah, well, maybe I will. Maybe I'll, I mean, like I said, I saw that one video, and maybe I'll feel compelled to say something about it online or in print sometime soon. But I don't know what there is to say. I mean, there's a lot of really, I mean, it's something I've said many times before. There's a lot of desperate people out there doing desperate things, move to do evil, horrendously evil things for one reason or another. I mean, it's a sick, sad world that we live in, and you know, as a writer or just as anyone, as a human being, you just got to navigate through and do the best you can with it.
And are there any characters in your recent book that have parallels to this individual?
Oh, well, I would say, interestingly enough, the character in the story we were just talking about, The Rape of the Therapist, there's probably some similarity there between him and this man. What's his name?
Elliot Rodgers. And that is the other
Elliot Rodgers.
The other coincidence, because in my story, and I wrote this, I want to make it absolutely clear, I wrote this, I didn't write it, I actually commissioned Anne Stirzinger to write this several months ago. So there's absolutely no connection. But the character's name is Roger Blackstone, and he kind of talks in like a pseudo-British accent. He uses lots of like kind of big words, and he's also kind of wants revenge in a sense,
right?
But not, he doesn't try to get revenge by through explicit violence, but he want more revenge through like sexual humiliation. But I was just kind of, when this happened, I was thinking like, oh, there's a lot of, are a lot of people going to be looking at my sitcom and trying to like make connections? And
right.
This is the one Anne Stirzinger is writing. She's writing for this, and she actually asked me what I thought about that, because she was the one writing it.
Mm. And did she come up with the name, or did you?
No, I came up with a concept. She just did the writing, but the whole idea of it is mine. And basically, my character's revenge is not the same, but he was a nerd in college, and he was in college there, and now he's an actor, and he wants to act out a modern day version of the Marquis de Sade's 120 Days of Sodom.
right. I remember the concept.
Yeah. And are you familiar with that book?
I'm familiar with it. I actually have not read it, but I know more or less what you're getting into with the Marquis de Sade. I mean, it's some pretty messed up stuff. I mean, 18th century. Heck, the guy was writing in the 18th century.
It's
still pretty still stands the test of time as far as really making you leaving an impression, let's just say. So you were, that sometimes happens though, you know, art imitates life, life imitates art.
I just have to be able to prove, cause I have to prove that I was the original, I came up with it before him, I'm not copying him, I'm just copying the concept. I have the evidence, like, I have the emails between me and Anne Stirzinger, or of writing it, so I have, I mean, I'm able to prove it if I absolutely have to.
Yeah, and I mean, there's a similarity in name, but like you say, and also there's, I guess, the sex obsession. But in his case, as, you know, as you pointed out, he's pretty much, the real life, guy has pretty much given up on sex and now just wants to wipe out a bunch of people, which I guess he ended up doing.
And my character is not necessarily totally the same. He's actually, he's kind of like a minor actor who spends all his money on like, escorts.
Right.
So he's not totally the same, but there are some similarities.
Right. But as far as this type, I mean, you know, the ex-nerd who wants revenge. I mean, I guess my character in Heart Killer is a lot like that. My character in The Columbine Pilgrim, Tony Meander, is definitely like that. And I think there, like I said, there's a little bit of that that turns up in this Malignant Mirage as well. I mean, I guess it's just a part of, you know, in what I've felt moved to write so far. There is
the one about
that
the
kind of guy.
Therapist. That one?
In the story, The Rape of the Therapist, I would say there's some similarity there. And maybe a couple other places. Like I said, I deal in, you know, desperation, is where I kind of like Dostoevsky, not that I'm comparing, I think I've made this point before. I'm not saying I'm Dostoevsky, I'm certainly not. Similar to him, he seemed to really, you know, get a lot of, inspiration from seeing, you know, recognizing people in a desperate state. And I think for me, you know, that's kind of, what's moved me to write is recognizing that desperation and having a certain compassion for it. Because there, it's sort of like, you know, I can relate to it. I can understand it. And I felt that way, you know, I haven't felt exactly that way, but I felt something like that, myself. And, I think if we're honest with ourselves, a lot of us know what it's like to feel desperate or lonely or thirsty for bloodthirsty, you know, wanting, desirous of revenge, all those kinds of things. You know, like I said, it's just part of life.
Yeah, and it's just when it comes to these people, it's just not politically correct to try to understand that individual. People either have to say
right.
The person is evil or they're insane.
Yeah, there is. I mean, that is something that happens. And I read somewhere, it was either on Twitter or Facebook, somebody saying mass shootings make people stupid. And I think that's true. There's all this, you know, whenever there's a shooting, and it happens way too often, let's be honest, there's something wrong with our, I think it's a cultural thing. I mean, there are messed up individuals in every age, but the phenomenon of the mass shooting says something about the culture in which we live, I would say, but I don't know where I would go from there. Exactly. But in any case, yeah, you wanna try to understand, and you wanna try to say, well, what made him do this? What caused him to snap? What were his motives? And there are a lot of people who respond to that in just this very, reactive sort of, anti-intellectual way, just like, you know, stop trying to make, like, as if, like they say things like, stop trying to justify it, as if trying to understand it is trying to justify it. You know, it's really, like I said, very anti-intellectual, just wanting to sort of shove it all to the side, wanting to just say, like you said, he's evil or he's crazy and that's all there is to say about it. But obviously there's more to say about it than that. That's probably part of the truth, but even evil people have reasons. There are always motives for doing what you're doing, whether it's, you know, one of the seven deadly sins or what have you. So yeah, school shooting or mass shootings like this, tend to just bring out the reactive tribal side, you know, whether it's people screaming about gun control or, you know, feminists talking about how his beliefs about women are insulting, or men's rights people, masculinists or manosphere types, saying this is the result of feminism or whatever. You know, I wish that people wouldn't just immediately run to their agendas, and like I kind of would like it if more people would just take it all in as a whole.
Yeah, even if you have certain movements or ideas you're sympathetic for, I think the key, like, I view myself as somewhat of a journalist, so you have to be as objective as you possibly can.
Yeah. Yeah, you wanna, yeah, I mean, and, you wanna try to, if you're gonna be a good, journalist, you wanna get all sides of the story, you wanna see, you're not telling people what to think, you're telling people what happened. There's a side of journalism today, it seems like, where, even in news stories, where they try to make you feel a particular way. Like, I remember, when Kim Jong-il called Obama a monkey that all the news stories were like, in using vile racist language, the North Korean leader insulted the president of the United States. You know, let us come to that conclusion ourselves. You know, don't tell us this is vile, you must hate this. And yet that sort of creeping into news stories
reminds me of the Fox News. Fox News has this slogan: "We report, you decide." So on my friend Robert Lindsay's blog, he has a parody of it that goes, I distort, you deride."
Right. they're definitely wanting to decide for you, in cases like this. And I think maybe that's why I haven't paid as much attention to this story yet. Just because it's the same old, people just having their reactions, having their tantrums or whatever. It's tiresome. I mean, I can understand people involved in it, people in the thick of it, people, you know, who lost friends or relatives. They're allowed to say whatever the hell they want. I mean, I'm not going to judge them at all, but these self-righteous commentators coming in and saying, basically exploiting this story, using it for their own ends, is just sickening, and it's something I just kind of want to turn your head away from and just not pay any attention to.
So back to your book on this malignant mirage. I guess one of the other stories we can talk about is so there's a man falsely convicted of a crime. So he takes his accuser hostage, and he subjects her to his own line of questioning. What exactly is the crime he's accused of? Is it sexual?
Yes, the story that you're referring to, that's another story from this Malignant Mirage. And like I said, there are certain thematic elements that turn up again and again. I guess the bondage submission element makes its way into many of these stories. In the story that we're talking about now, there's a man who is an English teacher at a private school who is falsely accused of making sexually harassing a student, and then who gets put on leave.
You must have seen that movie Pretty Persuasion.
I have seen it. Yeah, it's been a while.
Adam Rachel Wood. That must have been. Did that inspire you?
That was, well, I saw that movie. I remember it. It was a little while ago, yeah. But it was. I guess that there was a similar storyline there. But in this case, yeah, it's that's the circumstance of what's happened, and then he gets visited by the mother of this girl. Who's this beautiful society woman who's just recently been humiliated by her husband, who's left her for another woman. So she comes to his door, to give him a piece of her mind, and he's in this, again, this desperate state, because he's lost his job and he's lost his reputation, you know, and been falsely accused. And so it's a very volatile situation. She comes in to yell at him, and to, and to threaten him. But then she sees him and an attraction develops, and things go on from there, let's just say.
And, you have a story about a girl in college who becomes obsessed, with her, she becomes smitten with her death-obsessed professor. How is he obsessed with death?
the story that you're talking about now is, Motel Memento Mori. And it's similar. People who know my work might, note certain similarities to another story that I wrote called Motel Man, which is a part of the book Lost Violent Souls. It's part of that anthology. in which case the point is being made about a motel, what a motel is for and how it's a non-temporary place that sort of says something about, you know, that our life is temporary, and in a way, you know, this whole world is, this life is a motel that we spend a little bit of time in and then we have to check out. And this story, it's similar. It takes it, you know, in a different direction with different cast of characters and of course with an erotic twist. But this time it's about a girl, a beautiful girl, who's smitten with her English professor and who, visits him in his office, and he's got all of these pictures and mementos of death, and he's got a big skull on his desk, kind of like Yorick from Hamlet.
So it's not about necrophilia.
No, there's not. There's no. Nope, necrophiliacs are going to have to look elsewhere for their amusement.
Not necrophiliac friendly, I suppose.
No, I am not necrophiliac friendly. I do, yes, and that's one of them. Yeah. So they end up in the motel room, and he before they're as they're gearing up for this encounter, you know, the point is made that or there's sort of a there's an underscored point, which is about the phrase little death. You know, it's a French term for an orgasm, which is, I don't know, actually, I'm not literate enough to know the actual French term, but an orgasm is referred to as a little death.
Is it because as soon as the ejaculation takes place, the penis becomes totally flaccid?
No, I don't think it's more about just the sensation of it. It's like this convulsing, and then you go through, you know, and then it's you know, pass from one state to another, and so anyway, there's the story Motel Memento Mori. It's not about necrophilia, but there is a link that's established between sex and death, which kind of corresponds to what we've been talking about before, about how, you know, with sex there is a certain danger there. It's sort of like a here there be tigers kind of thing, you know, where you know, if you're not careful, it's going to lead you somewhere where you might not want to go, or where maybe you do actually want to go in the darkest recesses of your heart.
And then you have a story about a desperate housewife, and she has an unexpected dare to her hated henpecked husband. Can you say what the dare is, or you'd rather keep it a surprise?
Oh, well, this is the story that I talked about on Matt Forney's broadcast as well, on his podcast as well. yeah, the dare, it's a desperately unhappy marriage, and the wife is pregnant, but she's just disgusted with her husband for not having done anything to provide for them. Basically, he's a struggling writer, not really getting it done. And she had once revered him, but now she's just lost patience with him. And basically, her dare is for him to have an affair. She dares him. She says, "I bet you're not even enough of a man to do that." So he either does or he doesn't. He comes back with a story to tell her about what happened. But it's his story, and so there's some ambiguity as to whether it truly happened or not. but it once he tells her this story, it changes the dynamic between them as well. So once again, we've got this kind of battle of the sexes kind of thing, and we've got the man and the woman at odds, but something, you know, interesting, something different involving sex takes things in a different direction, takes things in an unexpected way, in an unexpected direction.
So, before I wrap up the show, is there anything else about the book that you'd like to add?
Well, just want to say this Malignant Mirage will probably hopefully you'll put a link up, when you post this, but, you can find it at, exclusively at erbooks.com. It's not on Amazon yet, but, the publisher sort of wants to get some sales done on his own site, and then maybe in a little bit, in a couple months maybe, he'll have it up on Amazon. And hopefully someday I'll have it and Heart Killer as well in print form. Right now they're both only available as ebooks. But you can find it at erbooks.com. Again, the title is This Malignant Mirage, and it's an anthology of erotic short stories that are, as I said, not just about sex, but also about a bunch of other stuff, about life, about desperation, about fear, about death, what have you. Like I said, there's some substance there that going on within or around all of the erotica, but I think my readers, people who have read my work in the past, or people who have just hearing about me for the first time, invite you to go to ER Books and check it out.
Andy Nowicki, I'd like to thank you for being on.
Well, thank you, Robert, for having me. It's been fun.
That's all we have for today's show, so take care, and we'll be back with you next time.